The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for May the 19th. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on this week's podcast, ahead of its grand reopening later this summer, we celebrate 200 years of science communication at the Royal Institution with two of the organisation's most distinguished members, science historian Frank James and nanotechnologist Quentin Pankhurst. Also in the show...
Overall, I think it's a bill that's both unethical and unnecessary.
As the embryology bill returns to the House of Commons, we hear the latest from supporters and opponents of human-animal hybrids, saviour siblings and posthumous sperm donation. Plus, astrobiologist David Kaitling takes us through the Phoenix Mars lander and the possibility of finding evidence for life on the red planet. And a letter from Einstein, health warnings on kebabs and lifting the lid on the UFO files. It's all coming up on Science Weekly from The Guardian. It's a packed studio this week, and certainly a case of invitation only. James Randerson is the Guardian science correspondent. James, you spent a day caged with monkeys last week. Did you? Are you having any flashbacks?
Well, I am in a confined space with some primates, so it is roughly similar, I suppose.
You've still not woken up from the nightmare, have you? Back in the pod and blonder than when we last saw her, it's Nell Bowes from the Guardian's arts team. What's with the hair, Blur?
Oh, I've been on the beach again.
Is that right?
Yeah, you just
you're always on holiday
it.
As well. Now then, we've got not one, but two special guests in the pod this week. Both of them are attached to the Royal Institution, not literally, of course, an organisation that's been devoted to the pursuit of scientific education and research for more than 200 years. Frank James is the RI's Professor of History of Science, as well as its Head of Collections and Heritage. And when Quentin Pankhurst isn't doing the day job as a nanotechnologist at UCL, he's busy being the new director of the RI's Davy Faraday Research Lab. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for coming in.
Hello.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, there's lots we want to cover today, so we're going to organise this slightly carefully. Frank, perhaps we can start with you. Tell us a bit of background about the Royal Institution for our international listeners who might not know what it is.
Well, the Royal Institution was founded in 1799 at a time of war. It's halfway through the war against France in the early 19th century. And it was designed specifically to deploy the resources of science for improving industry, for providing scientific advice to the state, and providing scientific education to educate the middle classes about the value of science for society. And it's always done that. What then happened very interestingly in very early on when Humphrey Davy was appointed professor of chemistry, was it then started having a research agenda. And Davy, having access to the laboratories of the Royal Institution, was able to discover sodium and potassium, and indeed in total 9 chemical elements of the periodic table were discovered by Davy. And that initiated the Royal Institution's reputation for research, which continues down to this day. I mean, his successor, Michael Faraday, invented the electric motor, electric transformer, electric generator, without which life as we know it would not be possible, and including this broadcast, and then in the work of people like John Tyndall, James Dewar, William Lawrence Bragg, George Porter, and current director Susan Greenfield, the RI has continued in that tradition, not only as a research institution, but also as an institution for promoting science to a broad audience. I mean, Faraday's lectures were hugely well attended. The Prince Consort came frequently. Later on, the Prince of Wales came to, later Edward VII came to the Royal Institution to attend lectures, and you can see that you could have seen them in the 1990s depicted on the old £20 note, which had Faraday on it.
We'll come back to Faraday actually just in a moment, because he's obviously a key figure in the history of the organisation and in terms of also the lectures that people still do in his name. But let's talk about what the institution is. I mean, people might have heard of the Royal Society as the Academy of Science in Britain, and there are equivalents of that all over the place in the world. It's the National Academy of Sciences and so on. But are there equivalents to the Royal Institution anywhere else?
Not really. The Royal Institution is actually unique. There aren't, that I can think of, organisations that have a major research programme, a major public programme, and now 2 centuries of history to look after. I mean, I suppose the Smithsonian in Washington comes closest, but that's a really rather different organisation.
They have museums and all sorts.
Yes. Yeah.
The RI's got a very imposing building in the middle of London, which is being refurbished. Now, that was why it's been closed for a few years. Tell us a bit about the refurbishment. Why did the director, Susan Greenfield, feel that this was a necessary thing?
Well, when she became director, she reversed the tendency of the Royal Institution of the past 20, 30 years to be a research institute with a public program attached to make the public program and the most important part of the World Institution. And we started increasing audiences, and it became extremely clear that the infrastructure of the building simply wasn't going to allow for that expansion to continue indefinitely. And so we started a program to redo the RI to offer people, have a restaurant, have a bar and bistro, which is terribly important in a city like the RI, that we just couldn't offer people even a cup of tea.
Somewhere for people to relax as well.
Somewhere
as enjoy
relax,
their science.
Mix, talk about science. So that has taken that's taken about £22 billion and 2 years of closure, and we will soon be launching again.
Part of that refurbishment, obviously, are the labs that you're heading up, Quentin. The cafe bars and things sound very nice as well for your researchers, but in terms of the lab space you're getting and what you're doing, I mean, people might be surprised to learn that there's going to be such high-tech research going on right in the centre of London. This is near Piccadilly Circus.
Well, it is incredible. The space that's there is quite well-established laboratory. There's a whole floor that's fitted out with the space that's suitable for the research that we do. The sort of things that we do are based around wet chemistry and also engineering. And we're keeping a very close connection with researchers at University College London and their medical school, so that we can maintain that continuity with the work that we're focusing on, which is towards healthcare applications.
Well, let's bring in some of the other Pod Squad. James, you got a question?
The RI is best known for the Christmas lectures, and you've had some real stars over the years doing those. I mean, is that what people ask most about when they come to the RI, or when they interact with the RI?
Well, certainly when people come into the Royal Institution and come up to the lecture theatre, they almost invariably ask, is this where the Christmas lectures come from? Because on television, lecture theatre looks so large.
It does.
But actually, when you're in it, it's a very, very intimate space, though it can hold 450 people.
I've got very long legs, and it's not very comfortable.
It is more comfortable. I went round, actually, the other day. There's more space now.
More
comfortable.
Right.
We've increased leg room by about half an inch, which is
fantastic.
Quite important if you've got a long thigh bone. actually, you need to find which... If you've been there a long time, you know exactly which seats to avoid and which seats to
That's obviously what I'm doing wrong.
But the Christmas lectures were founded by Faraday in the mid-1820s. They were first televised in the mid-1970s and have been televised ever since, every year on BBC Two and then latterly Channel 4 and Channel 5. Enormous audiences. I mean, they go to a broadcast of a million on the first broadcast, and then they're repeated. And now, for the past 10, 15 years or so, we've been taking the Christmas lectures out to Korea, Japan, and more recently,
International roadshow.
Absolutely. And I mean, they are terribly, terribly popular in Japan. I mean, the people are mobbed when they go to do the filming in Japan.
Frank, can you give us any indication of who's going to be doing this year's lectures? Can you give us a sneak preview? You're not allowed to tell us, are you?
I'm not allowed to tell you, I'm afraid, yes.
Nell, can you fit your long thigh bones into the RI's lecture theatre?
Just about. I remember watching Dawkins do them years ago. It was absolutely
fantastic.
Mesmerising. But I was wondering if you had any other new programmes. I mean, is there a summer lecture programme coming up, or what's the...
Well, now that we're launching the RI, which will be a sort of gradual process, starting with the Queen in a couple of weeks' time, we're building up our summer programmes. We're building up a schools programme. I mean, one of the Royal Institution, though it's best known for the Christmas lectures, we do run a programme of lectures and scientific events for children. And before we closed, we were having 30,000 children a year coming through the building to see real scientists doing real science, which in the current day and age of insurance and health and safety, it's becoming increasingly difficult in school. I mean, I know my daughter, for instance, only handled a Bunsen burner twice in her entire school career, and I suspect one of those was sort of slightly illegal. So what we do is incredibly valuable in promoting science education, and because we've so improved the infrastructure of the building, we anticipate really quite conservatively growing that school population to about 60,000 a year over the next 2 or 3 years after opening. And then the other thing we're doing is we're going to open a young scientist centre in the lower ground floor, where children, having attended lectures, and then go down and do their own experiments, carefully supervised, in the basement. lower ground floor. And a lot of those experiments will be sort of tailored towards the classic experiments, the iconic experiments done in the Royal Institution in the past. And then before or after, the children can go down the exhibition corridor, which is going to be outside the Young Scientist Centre, and see the world's first electric transformer, the world's first electric generator, the world's first thermos flask, and so on, and hopefully have a really inspiring experience coming to the Royal Institution.
Quentin, are they going to be allowed to do any of your experiments?
they'll be able to see some of the experiments because there'll be an exhibition lab that will be an actual real working lab where we'll be doing some of our preparation and testing of the materials that we're making and the things that we're working on.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
When it comes down to the history of the organisation, Frank, we mentioned Michael Faraday. Tell us a bit more about him. I mean, he's the main lecture theatre is named after him. The main science communication awards are in his name too. What kind of man was he, I mean, in terms of communicating to the public and telling people what he was up to?
Reading accounts of Faraday's lectures is quite an interesting experience because what you get are people recording, saying, went to hear Faraday's lecture, absolutely wonderful, brilliant demonstrations, wonderful exposition, etc. And then as soon as they got outside Old Mile Street, they thought, what the hell was that about? And I mean, there are lecturers even today who can sort of talk, engage the audience.
He's a hypnotist, isn't he?
Well, yeah, sort of. Make them think they're understanding what's going on in the lecture. But as soon as they get outside in the street and asked to give a coherent account of what they've just heard, are unsuccessful. But Faraday was hugely successful in doing that. I mean, in total, he gave 119 Friday evening discourses, which are our sort of flagship lecture series, and 19 series of Christmas lectures. People would vie to get in to attend lectures. I mean, there was one lecture in 1846, which was actually depicted illustrated London News at the time, which were attended by more than 1,000 people, and journalists were complaining they couldn't get in because it was so crowded. Faraday not only used those lectures for the people in the theatre itself, but he was very, very media savvy and would get lectures reported and, indeed, so far as I can make out, wrote a lot of the reports himself for weekly journals such as the Athenaeum and Literary Gazette, which were very important vehicles of cultural communication in the 19th century.
Does he have an equivalent today, do you think?
Not really, no.
Not even, maybe a few people altogether. James?
He seems like a remarkably sort of contemporary figure, really, because I mean, these days you hear so much about public understanding of science, public engagement with science, all of that, all of those sort of buzzwords, buzz phrases, and he was 200 years ahead of them, really. What was his does he ever kind of express his motivations for doing all this public engagement?
Yes, Faraday wanted to develop a rational experimental understanding of the world expressed in non-material terms, because he wasn't a materialist. He didn't believe in chemical atoms, for example. And he was absolutely opposed to fads like mesmerism, which he attacked, and particularly table-turning and spiritualism, which sort of went across England in a tidal wave in the early 1850s. And he... perhaps his most famous lecture, it's called something like on Mental Education, Observations of Mental Education, is a sustained critique of the English educational system as it then pertained, which had very little content for science. And from that point onwards in 1854, for the next 10 years or so until he effectively retired, he just attacked at every possible opportunity the English system, which concentrated on classics and on mathematics, and said we must have experimental science. And so far as I can make out, it's his campaign that got the Royal Commission on Education in Public Schools set up in the early 1860s, and he presented a lot of evidence to that to encourage science to go into schools. And that had a couple of consequences, that schools did start beginning to teach science, but also you've got new schools like Russell and Clifton being set up with an explicit mission to include a large proportion of science compared to the older schools.
Okay, well, as I've mentioned, we'll hear more from Quentin about the research that's going on at the RI a bit later. And both he and Frank are going to help us discuss the rest of the topics in the show. For now, though, let's pause for breath as we move on. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come...
The consequences of failure are unimaginable. And that's really the bottom line.
Mohan Munasinghe, Vice President of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, on the economic and social consequences of global warming. Plus, astrobiologist David Catling tells us more about the latest return to the red planet. First, though, here's a pick of the other stories making science headlines over the past 7 days. It's Nell and James with your News Jam.
News Jam.
A vaccine against one of the most feared childhood diseases, meningitis B, is a little closer after scientists revealed that a second stage of trials in babies had been successful. Within 24 hours of infection with meningitis B, a child can become severely ill and without the right antibiotics might die. In the experiment, babies were injected with the new vaccine at 2, 4 and 6 months of age, with a booster at 12 months. Antibodies showed the children had developed good immune responses against the bacteria.
A letter in which Albert Einstein branded religious beliefs as childish superstitions and the product of human weaknesses has been sold at auction in London for £170,000 to a private collector. It smashed the world record for a letter by the great scientist. Einstein penned the missive in 1954 to the philosopher Erich Gutkind. The letter went on sale a year later and has remained in private hands ever since.
The UK's Ministry of Defence has released 8 files on suspected sightings of UFOs between 1978 and 1987. It's part of a long-term project to make the information available to the vast number of UFO believers, sceptics and agnostics who have already deluged the government department for requests under the Freedom of Information Act. But experts remarked that it was unlikely to satisfy die-hard ufologists, even if all the data the government had was released.
And finally, scientists have found that a kebab contains up to the equivalent of a wine glass of cooking oil. One of the kebabs tested contained 140 grams of fat, twice the maximum daily allowance for women. Food scientists from Hampshire County Council tested the fat, salt and trans fat content of popular takeaway food, including Chinese and Indian meals, pizzas, kebabs and fish and chips. They found many of the dishes contained an entire day's fat in one meal, but by far the worst offender was the doner kebab.
Nell and James, thank you very much. We'll talk about kebabs later. The Einstein letter, James, take us through the story. I mean, it's the most read story on our website for the past week, I think. And £170,000 is what it went for in the end, but it was meant to go for much less.
Indeed, yeah. The Bloomsbury Auctions in Mayfair, who put it on sale, expected it to fetch between £6,000 and £8,000. But after we ran a story on Tuesday, they got an immense number of emails from potential buyers in the US overnight. And that seems to have stimulated a huge amount.
What kind of marketing department they had? Did they have? they didn't tell people that this was going to be on sale.
Well, I think arguably quite good, you know, in that they gave us a story which got lots of interest. But anyway, it went on sale on Thursday last week, and the price went up to £170,000. It went to a private bidder over the phones, who was an overseas bidder. They wouldn't tell me where, but I suspect it was a US bidder.
Well, we don't have the letter in question, but we do have a podcast version of it. Here's a sample.
The word God is for me nothing more than the expression and product of human weaknesses. The Bible, a collection of honourable but still pretty primitive legends which are nevertheless childish. No interpretation, no matter how subtle, can, for me, change this. For me, the Jewish religion, like all others, is an incarnation of the most childish superstitions, and the Jewish people, to whom I gladly belong, and with whose mentality I have a deep affinity, have no different quality for me than all other people. As far as my experience goes, they are no better than other human groups, although they are protected from the worst cancers by a lack of power. Otherwise, I cannot see anything chosen about them.
There's a cigar for anyone who can guess who that was. It wasn't really Einstein, of course. James, before we let the pod discuss this, there was a celebrity bidder as well, though, wasn't there, amongst the auction?
That's right. A certain Professor Richard Dawkins put in a bid.
How much?
He's a bit coy about exactly how much. Well, he said substantially more than the guide price, but substantially less than the final price. He said he was going to buy it with his own money for the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Science and Reason. I'll forget the exact phrase, but his foundation. And he just thought it would be a lovely thing to have, given that it's such a kind of concise exposition of Einstein's views on God.
It's funny, actually, the things that that are in that letter are a bit reminiscent of the stuff Christopher Hitchens says about religion being the sort of in the something that the childhood of our species does. Yeah. And so these things have obviously, you know, been thought of before. Frank, you've written about the relationship between science and religion before. I mean, how did you respond to this letter?
Well, this is the first time I've seen the text, and being a historian, I would actually need to see it in the context. I'm not familiar with the work of Eric Gutkin, which is what Einstein's responding to. But my initial reaction would be he's changed his position a bit since he famously said that God doesn't play dice with the universe. Now, while that can be read in a number of ways, it does suggest some kind of supernatural metaphysical entity writing the laws of nature into the universe, because you do, if you're a scientist, you do need to have some kind of metaphysical underpinning to guarantee the results that you do, because one experiment isn't going to sort of give you an absolute answer to anything. And I think it's significant that all the people whom Einstein most admired, and Einstein had four portraits of great scientific figures in his office in Princeton, were Galileo, Newton, Faraday and Maxwell, and he wrote about how much he admired those four figures, seeing them as the precursors to himself, although I think it's a bit unfair not to mention Lorentz, but that was probably a bit too much like competition for Einstein's liking. All of those four were profoundly religious in really wild different ways, and they were seeking to understand in their different ways, within their different religious traditions, the way God had written the laws of nature into the universe at the creation. And that's their metaphysical underpinning. I would need to go away and look at this and look at the context really rather more carefully than I can do in the studio in order to understand what Einstein is saying at this particular point. And also remember, it's just a year before he died, so he's sort of probably getting ready to find out whether there's an answer or not.
Let's move on from that, though. We can go on discussing this for the rest of the podcast, probably, otherwise. UFOs. James, again, this is another one of your stories. I'm just rapidly suspecting that, you know, you write the paper these days. UFOs. Tell us more about this. Again, actually, you've covered this a few times now.
Yes, this is the MOD getting thoroughly annoyed and reaching the end of their tether with conspiracy theorists, nutters, and journalists. Maybe nutters and journalists are the same thing. Sending in FOI requests on UFOs and saying, we want to know this bit of information, that bit of information. Huge administrative burden, huge amount of time taken up. And so they've just kind of put up a white flag and said, look, there's no kind of flying saucer in a hangar in Portendown or anything like that. So we're just gonna put everything we've got out there, and you can make of it what you will. There are no conspiracy theories here. Here you go. Here's the lot.
And obvious question: how do you know that's all they've got? I'm not a UFO believer. I'll tell you that right now.
That's clearly what the conspiracy theorists will say. But there's a huge amount of information that's going to go up over the next 3 or 4 years. It's 160 documents in all. 8 have gone up this month. There you can access them through the National Archives website. And each document is not just one report. It's a whole collection of things. You know, one of them is over 450 pages long. So there's an immense amount of information there.
Is anyone here a UFO believer?
Well, I'm certainly not. And I think one needs to put this in its historical context, in that these appearances, these studies were done during the Cold War. And there was no indication that the Russians weren't sort of doing something which sort of could be interpreted as UFOs. And the Ministry of Defence, being a sort of fairly paranoid type of organisation, felt it incumbent to do these really quite large scale examinations of these sightings, alleged sightings, at our expense. They weren't doing this work because they thought aliens were about to come. They were doing it in case the Soviets had found a new technology to invade British airspace.
So the MOD was just protecting us, James.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Frank. That was the MOD's interest. They were looking for events of defence relevance, they really weren't interested in little green men. But the interesting thing about the records is, I mean, there are a fair few letters from, quite colourful letters from people who, you know, claim to have been in contact with aliens since they were seven. And there's one guy who says he's been in contact with an alien called Algar, who he built up a relationship with, and he wanted to introduce him to the Prime Minister. But unfortunately, Algar was then killed by another set of extraterrestrial beings, tragically. So the meeting never happened. So there's that kind of stuff in there. But there's also much more interesting sightings by really credible people, like fighter pilots and civil aviation pilots, air traffic controllers, police, people like that. And you know, some of them are genuinely unexplained. And so, you know, in the true sense of the word, they are unidentified flying objects. But there's no evidence they're actually little green men.
We'll consider the idea of life on other planets a bit later with David Kettling when we talk about the Mars Phoenix lander. But let's move on to something a bit more serious. The embryology bill is set to return to Parliament this week to be debated again. It's a controversial bit of legislation, to say the least, and the cause of much vehement disagreement between its advocates and adversaries. Now, we've discussed it a few times in the past in the pod, including last week, and we took the Science Weekly microphone to Westminster to hear both sides of the argument this time.
Ian Gibson, I'm Labour MP for Norwich North. I do support research and endeavour by people to try and improve other people's lives through medical advance, and there's an opportunity here to provide that with the ideas of producing stem cells. I'm also here because I think there's a real argument about Save Our Siblings. I don't think everybody agrees with what I agree, but it's worth the argument because we are now in that position. We've had to do that. We've had two cases in this country, and because there was a positive in one case and a negative in the other, we're very confused. We have to debate that issue. And I just think in general this whole area now, because of the advance of science, has led us into new pathways and where legislation is going to be necessary. So we have to debate it.
My name's Dr. Peter Saunders and I'm the General Secretary of Christian Medical Fellowship. We've got an interest in issues at the interface of Christianity and medicine, faith and medicine. Overall, I think it's a bill that's both unethical and unnecessary.
My name's Hannah Scott, and I'm a type 1 diabetic. I live with type 1 diabetes. I've had it for 19 years now. I also work for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, who are the largest voluntary funder of research into a cure for type 1 diabetes in the world. This bill has huge potential for research. Stem cells, and especially embryonic stem cells, can be key in the future to providing the cure for type 1 diabetes and for a lot of other conditions. If we don't have the ability to use those cells and to work with them to find that research and do more work, then really we're shutting off a huge avenue forward.
Dr. Evan Harris, Liberal Democrat MP, member of the Innovation, University, Science and Skills Select Committee, and a strong supporter of the bill. Well, I think it's important that we update our legislation. I think this is highly ethical research that's very carefully regulated and has the potential to produce not only insights into the causes of serious diseases, but also potential therapies, whether they be models, cell models for testing drug treatments, or indeed the potential for cell therapy itself, using embryonic-derived stem cells as a way of replacing degenerating cells. Now, that's all in the future, but we'll never get there unless it's permitted to do this research.
Liberal Democrat MP Dr. Evan Harris finishing us off there. Quentin, is he right? We're not going to get there unless we allow this kind of research to go on, this idea of hybrid embryos and so on.
Well, I think it's absolutely vital to have a very positive attitude towards cellular-based therapies and research that's aimed towards curing incurable diseases in man. And I think that it's perfectly sensible that there be legislation through the government to establish a dividing line between the extremes of that research in an ethical context, because it's extremely important to have the buy-in or the understanding of the general public about what we're doing. We don't want to be in a situation where we're creating Frankenstein monsters. That's not the purpose. The purpose is stopping people dying and stopping people having debilitating diseases which are totally incurable. There are some fantastic potentials out there. We're doing some work ourselves in the David Faraday lab, looking at modifying stem cells, which are the healing cells in our human body, which are normally present in very, very small numbers and hard to get at places like inside your bone marrow. but by taking a patient's own stem cells and modifying them in a way which is perfectly safe and straightforward, we can increase the potential for using them to treat diseases like atherosclerosis or cardiovascular disease. And to my mind, if you have the opportunity to do that, it's unethical not to.
I totally agree. Well, we'll go from one perennial subject to another. Climate change, James, you went to hear a talk on this last week.
Yeah, this was Mohan Munasinghe, who is the Vice President of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was speaking at a lecture in Cambridge, sponsored by Clare College. To be honest, it was quite a sort of depressing message all round.
It's not a good story, is it, climate change?
Yes, this is true. I mean, and it's, there's only so many times, in a way, you can kind of listen to the doom and gloom message, but... Anyway, here it is again. This is an abridged version of his talk.
What we fear is that unrestrained market forces will increase the risk of conflict, and particularly without the ethical and moral underpinnings. So climate change is or could be the additional factor which will exacerbate the existing problems of poverty, environmental degradation, social polarization, and terrorism. And it could lead to a very chaotic situation. Fortress world is a situation where the rich live in enclaves protected and the poor live outside in unsustainable conditions. If you see what is going on in some of the gated communities in some countries, you do find that rich people live in those kind of protected environments. If you see the restrictions on international travel, you see the beginnings of the fortress world syndrome even in entering and leaving countries. So this is not a tendency that we would like to encourage, because that would be probably lead to complete a disaster, in my view. We want to stop looking at the world piecemeal. This is the high-risk world, a reactive world. We want to go to the immediate drivers, try to make development more sustainable, be more proactive. And if we are successful in that transition, we can really go, I think, to a very positive long-term future, where we can address some of the underlying pressures and really look at a global civilization which can last a very long time. I tend to be optimistic because I believe that this can be done through rational processes, but I also feel that the consequences of failure are unimaginable, and that's really the bottom line.
Mohan Munasinghe there, and you can hear his full interview as this week's Science Extra if you go over to guardian.co.uk/environment. Let's move on now, but if you want to have any of your say on the stuff we've talked about, head to the Science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science, or post a comment on the Facebook wall. Oh, and suffice to say, don't eat too many kebabs. The prospect of people living on Mars may come just a little bit closer to reality this week, well, sort of, with the landing of a new probe. The Phoenix Mars lander is designed to find out whether the planet can, or perhaps even does, support life. David Catling is an astrobiologist at Bristol University and a co-investigator on the Phoenix science team. I asked him how the new lander will differ from the two famous Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity.
Well, Phoenix is much bigger than the rovers. So the rovers you can think of as sort of little dog-sized spacecraft that wander around the surface, and that of course has the great advantage of giving you a big horizontal scale to traverse. Phoenix doesn't move. Once it gets down on the surface of Mars, it's going to sit in one place, but it, instead of going horizontally, it can go vertically with its robotic arm, so it could dig up to half a meter deep, if you like, which is something that the rovers cannot do. And the surface of Mars is basically, we think, more or less sterile. And the reason for that is because Mars has no ozone layer, so the ultraviolet rays come through and destroy organic molecules on the surface. And it's also extremely dry. So if you want to look for signs of life on Mars, present or past, then what you really need to do is get under the surface. And so Phoenix has this advantage of being able to dig down.
Is the one of the main goals of the experiment then to look for these signs of life? I mean, that seems to be something that most people want to find on Mars.
Yeah, so Phoenix actually really is going to be the only mission, assuming it's successful, since the Viking landers in the mid-1970s, has the capability to look for organic molecules, molecules of the type that make up living organisms. Possibly, in the ice on Mars, in the permafrost underneath the surface, these kind of molecules could be preserved. I mean, it's a place that you would find molecules on the Earth. And in addition, by looking at the chemistry of the soil and the air, we can also get some environmental information about whether it's a suitable habitat for life on Mars as we dig down.
The Phoenix lander's scheduled to land on Sunday. It's coming Sunday, May the 25th. Are you nervous?
A little bit. I mean, Mars is a difficult planet to land upon based on the historical record of spacecraft that have been sent to Mars. Of the 13 landers that have gone there, only five have landed successfully. So, you know, you can work out the odds for yourself. But my feeling about this particular mission is that it was, unlike some of the others, it was funded properly, and an awful lot of hard work has gone into the testing of the systems for landing. But you're right that the whole thing does come down to sort of 6.5 minutes when the spacecraft is rushing into Mars from space at a speed which is in excess of 12,000 miles per hour. And then in 6.5 minutes, it goes through the atmosphere and has to come to rest on the surface. And everything basically has to work correctly in that critical time. So, you know, that's the make or break time on May the 25th, when Phoenix will either land successfully or it will not. I think it makes everybody nervous because we've spent years building up to this. I remember when this was just a concept on paper, you know, we had sort of 25 sheets of paper with a description of what this mission should look like. And it's gone from that to actual hardware, which got bolted onto a spacecraft, launched at Cape Canaveral, and is now imminently going to land on Mars. So it makes all of us a bit nervous as to whether, you know, all of that hard work is going to pay off on May the 25th or not.
David Kaitling there from Bristol University. There's plenty more on this story in the Red Planet at guardian.co.uk/science. Let's return to the subject of the Royal Institution. Quentin, this is your bit now. I wanted to talk to you more as your role as the director of the RI's Davy Faraday Research Lab. You've already talked a little bit about the stem cell work you're going to be doing there. Can you just highlight for us some of the other bits and pieces you're focusing on at the start?
Well, my real passion is for using magnetic materials and magnetic particles for healthcare applications. And in a sense, I see myself as following on the tradition of Faraday in that he was a great believer and understood at a much deeper level than people before the power of electricity and magnetism. So one of the things that we're working on is you're probably familiar with iron filings in that you can move them around with a permanent magnet. Well, we can do amazing things with those in terms of targeted drug delivery in the human body and the stem cell application I was describing earlier. But you can it's not just moving particles that you can do with a magnet. You can do something even more amazing, which is you can make them heat up. You can create heat from within a magnet by placing it in a time-varying magnetic field. It's a bit like the magnetic analog of a microwave oven. In a microwave oven, the electric dipole moment of the water molecules. If you've ever had an electrostatically charged rod and managed to deflect a little flow of water, you'll see how water is electric. It's why you should never put a toaster in your bath.
there you go. Don't do it, kids.
But you can do similar things with light, with the magnetic part of electromagnetic radiation, and you can, in a similar way, but here you're using the magnetic dipole moment.
What kinds of things can you treat like that?
Well, we're very keen. We have a long-term strategy. We're hoping that in 10 to 15 years, we can have something that will lead towards very localized treatment of things like metastatic cancer. So one of the big issues with cancer treatment these days is that it's relatively easy to find a primary tumor. But as people are well aware, I'm sure, it's usually the secondary cancers that kill us. And those spread all over the body, and they're very hard to locate. So we're working with oncologists, Kerry Chester and colleagues at the University College London, to design ways of getting magnetic particles attached to little proteins called antibodies, which you can inject into the bloodstream, and they will home to the tumour, wherever it might be.
See, that's a fantastic idea, because it's when people have cancer, one of the most horrible things about it is the chemotherapy drugs, which you have to take for the whole body almost, and it kills all sorts of things other than the cancer.
Absolutely.
So being
right.
able to target them with these magnets would be fantastic. I mean,
absolutely
when can we expect this to happen?
Oh, as soon as possible, as soon as possible. But don't expect anything for a good many years yet. Actually, one of the interesting things about chemotherapy is that it's the way that it treats all the healthy cells in your body that causes such a stress. So one of the nice things about the magnetic particles is that if you heat them up, even just a little bit, it makes the chemotherapy and radiotherapy at that site much more effective. So by simply using the magnetic particles alongside the chemotherapy, it may be possible in the future to reduce the reliance on the huge doses that have been used for the drugs, and therefore cut back some of the side effects.
James, you've got a question.
Yeah, one of the things I've heard mention of is a handheld scanner for surgeons. Can you tell us a bit about that?
That's another thing. It's a bit like a handheld MRI scanner. We've got this very nice device which allows us to measure 1/1,000,000th of the Earth's magnetic field in an operating theatre. We've actually already trialled this. It is amazing. It is amazing. It's something that there's lots of tricks associated with the design of this instrument. But we've actually done clinical trials on this already in University College London Hospital with Michael Dewick, who's a surgeon at UCH. We've looked at 12 patients so far, very successful results. And it's
what's it actually, apart from, what does that magnetic field change tell you?
We use it for staging the treatment of breast cancer. So it's used in cancer operations. Well, again, it's a question of trying to understand whether or not cancer has spread in the body. So when you have breast cancer and you have a tumour, it's relatively easy to see the tumour, and the surgeon will operate to remove it. But there's a question, has the cancer spread? And that's vital to know, because in 10% of all cases, there is a recurrence of the cancer. So we rely on some very well-established medical facts, which are that if the cancer spreads, it spreads through the fluid that bathes all the cells in the body called the lymph. And it passes through lymph vessels, which are like blood vessels, and it gets filtered out by, like cigarette filters. They're called lymph nodes. There's about 30 of them in your armpit. And our probe allows the surgeon to identify the node that's standing guard over the one node that's standing guard over the tumour. It's called the sentinel node.
Right, so do you sort of work upstream from that to find where the tumour?
Well, we do, but it's based around keyhole surgery. So it's a very simple operation. We just dive in, take out the sentinel node, and then it's looked at under a microscope. And the great thing is that there is an absolute definite answer at the end of this operation. The patient can be told, I'm sorry, you've got metastatic cancer, you're going to go on to this treatment, but it's worth it because you've got that cancer. Or they're told, you're okay, and you can go on a much smaller dose of chemotherapy, radiotherapy. The post-surgery treatment is much more defined.
Quentin, I'm excited about it. Quentin, I introduced you at the beginning as a nanotechnologist, and when people think of nanotechnology, you might think of little tiny machines or something going into your cells or building themselves and that kind of thing. Exactly. So this is what I was coming to. Whereas what you're talking about is drugs, targeted drugs, and you and the actual practice of nanotechnology is very different to what people think. Can you just tease that apart a little bit for us? You know, why would we say that what you're doing is nanotechnology?
Well, I think that the greatest invention you could say was the wheel. You didn't have to create a jumbo jet to prove that a wheel would roll down the hill, and you can do fantastic things with a wheel rolling down a hill. Nanotechnology, all of this stuff about nanorobots, I hate the idea. It's so much 22nd, 23rd century stuff. You know, if it ever comes about, why there's so much more that we can do right now just using the fact that we are able to make small particles, small materials, small electronic circuits, whatever, on the same scale as a cell or a virus or a protein or a DNA molecule. That is the big opportunity area, I think.
Frank, one of the more interesting things about the relaunch of Royal Institution is that people are going to be able to see Quentin's research team in action in the basement and actually watch these guys do their stuff. What do you think that that does for people sort of walking through and kind of to see that people are actually in action?
Well, what we hope it will do is to demystify the figure of the scientist. I mean, so often scientists are portrayed stereotypically as sort of people doing funny things in laboratories, wearing white coats as some kind of sort of priestly garb or whatever. What we want to do is to try and show that they're actually normal people. And I don't know about Quentin's laboratory, but in my observation of laboratories around the place, most scientists simply sit around typing into computers and drinking coffee most of the time. And that's the sort of image we want to create. The scientists are like everybody else. They're not some kind of distinct subspecies of human beings. And that's terribly important if we're to try and ensure that people understand that science is a human activity and not something that's away from the rest of society and is in some sense threatening. In one of my favorite phrases from Susan Greenfield is that one of the objects of the RI is to mesh science with society, and that's what we are really trying to do with the new RI as we launch it and sort of move towards opening over the summer.
Nell, are you going to be going along?
Oh, certainly. And I also wanted to ask just sort of one last question. It's been a pretty illustrious couple of hundred years. What do you see for the next couple?
Well, I'm a historian, not a futurologist.
That gives you the perspective to be able to answer on a suitable scale.
I'm afraid history is neither science nor a predictive science. But what we're trying to do, as I said just now, is to humanise science, to show that science is an integral part of society. And the bit of the redevelopment I've been particularly concerned with is the heritage displays. And as I said, we've got the first electric motor, we've got the first electric transformer, first electric generator, and so on. And what we want to do is to try and use the present to link in to people's perceptions of the past so they can understand something about the future. And that's why history of science is extremely important in helping people appreciate the impact of scientific research on their everyday lives. I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about is Faraday's work on field theory. Without Faraday's field theory of electromagnetism, we wouldn't be able to talk now, because that's the basis of the transmission of radio waves. And so it's those sorts of things that we want to try and get across, both in terms of exhibition and in terms of our public programs. And Quinton's laboratory is an integral part of a strategy to humanize science.
I think another aspect of that is that I think it would be good for people to realize that science isn't all about major discoveries and fantastic things happening every day. You know, the apple didn't fall out of the tree and hit Newton on the head 100 times a day. It happened once. And I think that what people will have an opportunity to see is that real scientific research involves an awful lot of doing the same thing again and again and just tweaking things. And actually, there's some work and dedication and effort required to see things through. And hopefully that will help to help people to realise that it's not so different from their job.
You know, this thing about doing things again and again, it sounds just like doing this podcast. We're going to draw things to a close now. Go to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed this week. And if there's something you want to say to us about iTunes, football adverts, or I don't know, proper scientific things, post a comment there or on our Facebook wall. My thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Nell Bowes, and our special guests, Frank James and Quentin Pankhurst. Quick thing from both of you just now. When does the RI open? When can the public sort of descend?
Well, the Queen is launching the RI on the 28th of May, and we have a sort of continuing programme of opening the RI throughout the summer. And go to the RI webpage, which is something like
RIGB.org. I've got it written down here. There you go. I had that already. Well, Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, and my, how we missed you these last 2 weeks, says here on the script anyway. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.